limits our ability to talk to people. I'm headed to Kentucky tomorrow. You know, where you got people who've been called everything. And, you know, we got coal miners and folk from Harlan County that voted 89% Republican, but they're gonna be with us tomorrow. They don't wanna hear about left versus right. They wanna hear about the moral center. They wanna hear about love and justice and policies rooted in righteousness. They, you know, and then the third reason is it allows you to have so much ability to gather folk, you know, by saying moral language. Well, somebody says, well, I'm not a Christian. Okay, fine. Do you believe in the moral precepts of the Constitution? You know, domestic tranquility, establishing justice, providing for the common defense, promoting the general welfare. You come on in there. You know, however you frame it, what we have found is there's an interrelatedness to the moral traditions, the moral law, if you will, of the universe. And that language has helped us. People find themselves, people are coming from all different walks of life and religions and places and spaces that are coming in because it allows you to get real simple. I know I'm in the cathedral, but where you can say, this just ain't right. I mean, it's not being so deep. It's something that ain't right. That's more or less about 37 million people not having health care, and we're the only of the 25 wealthiest nation. I mean, forget all the left and right and Republican and Democrat. Something just ain't right about that, right? Something just is not right about 13 million poor children. Here we are 100 and some odd years after the Emancipation Proclamation. We had the worst child poverty in the industrialized world. Just something just not right, moral language, that's what we mean. And because then you can have a kind of moral righteous indignation. And if you look back at the great, great servants, whether it was Cesar Chavez or Martin Luther King or Dorothy Day or Rabbi Heschel, and you keep going, you never heard them frame their issues in a limited framework. You know, Dr. King talking about Democrat versus Republican. He talked about the moral arc of the universe. He talked about something that could challenge every person. Because if we don't do that, then what you do is you say left, they got a right position, the right has a right position. Then you end up giving a false equivalency to some things that are not about left versus right. They're about right versus wrong, period. Yes. Period. And we need that kind of moral imagination, because left versus right, conservative versus, and I think people, last thing I'm gonna say before, people say, Reverend Barber, you're on the religious left. No, I'm not. They say, well, you are a religious liberal. Yeah, I am. Well, I'm also a religious conservative. Yes. They say, well, what do you mean by that? I said, well, first of all, there are 2,000 scriptures in the Bible about how you treat the poor, the least of these, and the stranger. So how do you call yourself a conservative if you're not even conserving the very essence of the Bible? To conserve means to preserve, to hold on to. Mm-hmm. So how is it that you call yourself a conservative and 95% of what you talk about you can't even find scriptural basis for, and you're dismissing the majority? But I'm also a liberal, because when it comes to love and justice and mercy, I want to liberally spread that everywhere. So you're not going to lock me into some box. And moral language does that. It disempowers people from locking us in a box, and it gives us an authority to speak from a deep moral place that can challenge everybody in the nation to do better.
Yes.
I know you've got to make the most of your time, and let me say thank you for your authenticity first, in being who you are. Yeah, I know you said you're in the cathedral, but I was just whispering to you as well. I haven't been here that long. I'm a Baptist. He had me hollering in the cathedral.
Oh,
so in that, I'm grateful for your authenticity. What would you tell us that we need to be doing right now that would help this situation before you
go? I want you in a moment to listen to this, to a woman who is as clear as anybody I know, clearer than me, and Liz Steele Harris, as she lays out this campaign, and Roz Pelas, and they talk about the next. We are not, this is not a moment, it's a movement. We've spent years without cameras, without seeing going and visiting people. This is people in 40 states and the District of Columbia rising up. This is a birthing. This is a launching. It is a commencing, not a commencement. So we're birthing a movement, a multi-year movement, in these 6 weeks. Three focuses: change the narrative, engage massive voter mobilization among the poor and impacted, and to build power among the poor and impacted, along with moral leaders and advocates and others, led by and with the poor. 6 weeks, 6 weeks, 40 days. That's a biblical number. 40 days to birth, not to end, to birth. So we need you to tell everybody you know to be a part of these Monday actions, these nonviolent moral fusion, civil disobedient Mondays all across the nation. It's never happened before. Simultaneous actions in state capitals all across the nation, same time, same place. That's not happened. Historians tell us it's not happened. Already, over 2,000 people have presented themselves for civil disobedience. And we're going to break through this narrative. We'll bring it. Liz will talk more about that. And then the third thing, I might be off to one, two, threes because I'm tired, but anyway, the next thing is on June the 23rd, we need you to tell everybody to reject it, that all roads lead to D.C. at 10 o'clock on the West Capitol lawn, because we're having a call to action rally. Now, this is different. It's not going to be the end. This is a calling to action, and the primary voices are going to be the impacted people, right? People who are saying, we are coming together. People like Callie Greer that says, look, my daughter died in my arms because I didn't have health care. I've mourned, but now it's time for me to turn my mourning into a joyous rebellion against the system that would do this. That's what's happening. So we need you to tell everybody. And since I like to joke a little bit, because in a movement, don't trust anybody, can't joke a little bit. Now, you all know, if I went up in that pulpit this morning, and for some strange reason, I had leaned over and fell off, you all would have texted everybody in the world, wouldn't you? Everybody in the world see it. Everybody would know. And they would say, Lord, have mercy, give me that cane. They said, Reverend Barber was up there, and he just tilted right over. Everybody would know. Well, we want you to gossip about the 23rd of June. We want you to tell everybody. And those of you in Washington, help us make the crowd every Monday at 2 o'clock and join in the actions at 3 o'clock. But help us build this massive moral fusion coalition of the rejected and show the nation, not that we have just had 40 days of commemoration, but we've had 40 days of resurrection, 40 days of re-engagement, and that this remnant is going to make it better for the whole, and we've only just begun. Listen to Liz, listen to Roz, because they know it like nobody else. And may I have permission to leave and go to Kentucky with my good folk? Thank you all so much. God bless you.
Let's tell him thank you today.
Thank you. God bless y'all. Forward together.
We're thankful, certainly with the adjustments in the weather and moving, that Bishop Barber's on his way, of course, and we want to encourage each and every one. As we've heard Bishop Barber set the tone for us on today, for those who have stayed and, of course, are here, to really be moved further in understanding and action. I've mentioned those who are with us, of course, on the panel, and I'm thankful, of course, Ryan, that you're here. As we've talked about some of the broad aspects of all we need to do, and we recognize this is a movement that's happening in other areas, we want to make it real. And Bishop Barber talked this morning about reality. And many people today are living in what we might call virtual reality. They make their own space, their own understandings. But can you help us this morning, because you've been on the front lines, and talk to us about what you've seen here in the communities in which we live, work, and worship?
So thank you for having me. I'm a native Washingtonian. I've been here 39 years. I was born and raised east of the Anacostia River in one of the poorest wards in our city, and has been that way for the 39 years I've been in existence. And so that tell of two Americas is a tell of two DCs. There is the wealthy DC that is prospering, and then there is the poor DC that is suffering. It is the poor DC whose schools are just horrendous. Our schools, our children, the reading percentage on average of an elementary school child in east of the river is under 26%. And so if we lose them in elementary school, they've already set their minds to drop out in middle. And if we don't catch them there, then they won't graduate. And then we talk about an unemployment rate. We talk about a crime rate where all of it is just tied together. And so on one end, our mayor and our city officials say crime is down. How many of you have heard the last 7 months, 6 months, crime's down in DC? Overall, crime's down. There have been 63 murders in our city, primarily east of the river. That's a 47% increase from last year this time. The shootings are up by 50, 60%. On last Friday night, my cousin was, he had gotten home from work, decided to go back to the old neighborhood because he no longer lives there, just to kind of see his friends and say hi. He was shot in his stomach, and now he's in a hospital literally fighting for his life because he just decided to stop in just to say hi to some friends on a Friday night. And some will beg to say, well, he was at the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, if that would have happened outside of the cathedral doors, would he have been at the wrong place at the wrong time? But because it happened east of the river, it was wrong place, wrong time. And that should not be our narrative. We need to focus in on education. If we say education is the key, then that's what we need to focus in on with our children, helping them. It's not good that I've dubbed this west of the river now. It's west of the river and east of the river. West of the river kids are prospering, while east of the river kids are dying. They're dying because there is one hospital for over 100,000 residents east of the river. There are only three grocery stores for 100,000, over 100,000 people east of the river. Three grocery stores. But if you go down H Street, you have three places where you can shop. If you just take H Street on down, you have the Giant, you have Whole Foods, and you have the Walmart. And that's just on one stretch of street. But if you go east of the river, you in Ward 7, there are two grocery stores. In Ward 8, there's just one. Ward 8 has the highest concentration of children who are living in poverty, children who are not healthy. Ward 8 has, and with that, United Medical Center is the only hospital east of the river. And if you watch the news, it has no trauma center where 35 people have been killed or shot, but they have to go to Howard University, they have to go to George Washington, they have to go to Georgetown, cross over in DC traffic. And they die, some die almost on route, whereas this hospital has no trauma unit. Ward 8 has the highest mortality of babies and mothers dying during childbirth, but they have no pediatric unit. They have no OBGYN unit. It's been closed down, but there is no moral outrage. There is no one saying that those black and brown babies east of the river matter. They're not hearing their mother's cry. They're not hearing our cry, because we know crime is not down. We know crime is up. We know that it has been steady for decades east of the river, and people have been wailing. They have been crying, but nobody wants to hear their cry, and nobody wants to fix the school system. They thought school choice was a good thing. Where it took money from neighborhood schools, where now there are some neighborhood schools that maybe that are now condos.
You know, I want to thank you for making it real. We've come here in the afternoon not just so that we would have these thoughts in our heads, but that we would be moved into action even further. And for many, it has to be made real in the things that we're turning our head to. So I thank you very much for putting it this way. And because, as she said, something's just not right. And we've got to know what it is, those things that are just not right. I want to ask you, Reverend Liz, certainly as she has raised this and making it real, you've been organizing for over 20 years. As I said, you've been on the front lines in so many different places. Share with us as well as what you've seen around the country and what you're dealing with in the midst of the campaign now.
So just like we just heard from Ryan, that there's a war on the poor here in D.C. There's a war on the poor across this country. And they're, just like Ryan, real heroes and heroines, real saints that are rising up to do something about that. So over the past years and decades, we've been traveling around to many of the poorest communities in this country and finding that it's exactly there that there's hope, that things don't have to continue this way. So we were in El Paso, Texas, and waded into the Rio Grande River with families that had been separated for decades. And folks were given 3 minutes for Border Patrol to turn their backs, not pay attention to the kind of imaginary line in the middle of the river that separates families and makes it impossible for folks to live full lives with their kids, with their grandkids, with their aunts, with their nieces. Mm-hmm. We were in Grays Harbor, Washington, a little town at the end of the earth, or at least the end of this country, where out of 15,000 people that live in the area, 1,000 of them are homeless. Some of the highest rates of homelessness in this nation. And these are mostly poor, white millennials. The lumber industry has left, and people are left with nothing. We've been in Lowndes County, Alabama, and anyone that shows up tomorrow to take part in our actions will hear from folks out of Lowndes County, Alabama, where in 2018, kids are playing in raw sewage because there's not sanitation services for many, many families. The businesses in the area have gotten the sanitation services, but the poor families are being criminalized and having to live in their own waste. This is 2018. This is one of the richest countries in human history. We have the ability to build a prefab house in 45 minutes, but there are millions of people who are homeless. People are dying on east of the river, despite the fact that there's high-tech medical equipment, services, just a couple miles away. But people don't have access to that health care. And so what we're seeing across this country is that people are rising up, that people are organizing. And it's not that other people are telling folks that are poor and homeless and uninsured they're going to help them, they're going to save them, but that poor people themselves have been able to band together with moral leaders and clergy, with advocates and activists, and say, we can turn this country around. We can make life better for everybody. Somebody's hurting our people, and it's gone on for far too long, We won't be silent anymore, and we're going to organize, we're going to organize, we're going to organize, and we're going to save the soul of this nation.
I thank you for that. As you are both have answered this and helped to make it real for us, we've got our seminary trained and our clergy, and they tell me now we have the attorney. Is that correct? The attorney that's sitting here, and folks say when you want to get something done, get a good attorney. So in this, as you've seen it today, there are many who, when we speak about changing things, they're looking at policies. And all that we really need to change, not just in our thoughts, but change in our policies. Could you speak a little bit about how that is going to be done and how we balance that even with our faith perspectives and setting policies that will help those who are poor?
So this whole question of change by policy is an important one, and it matters. But the question really is, how are policies changed in this country? And policies are changed in this country when people demand the change. And that's what we have to be. That's our job. And so there are a lot of folks of goodwill who are policymakers, but we need to make them do that. And we've heard them time and time again say that. And we have to take them seriously. We have to do that. We have to show them that we are backing them. We have to give them backbone to move ahead. But we need change in policy. But that comes from the people. Policy change comes from the people. It comes from everybody in this room. And so I would urge folks to join this campaign and to join campaigns wherever you are who are watching this, to do what we have to do in this country. Because what we are seeing around the country, what we're seeing is that people are moving, they're rising up, and they're doing it because, not because there's a certain change in the White House, but because they understand that in order to have a life that we all deserve in this country, that they have to do something, they have to come together across all lines and to do what we have to do to change this country.
We're making the most of the time that we have in this today. And I just want to ask a broad question for all three of you to respond to, giving you time as well. We're talking about change, demanding change, making change. How do you reach and get persons motivated to change a system that they're benefiting from? And right now, many of those who we're talking about helping right now, they're going to be out there on the front lines, and you've raised about us supporting them and being with them. You all have been motivated to help them. But some of the things that we're talking about changing, many people are benefiting from. And while we may want change, we may not be so inclined to receive change. As I said, everybody wants change until it knocks on their front door. And so how would you address that for individuals to say that they need to move, we need to move? Those of us who are sitting in the cathedral today need to get involved in this, but you're asking us to somehow give up some things or sacrifice some things. How do you address that for those, and especially us who are sitting here today? I open that to whoever wants to jump in there first.
Okay, I guess I'll be the brave heart, brave soul. So there's this quote, I always get it wrong, but it says, when they came for, it wasn't me, so I didn't do anything. When they came for the, and you can put whatever you want, it wasn't me, so I didn't, and so forth and so on. But when they came for me, no one was there. And so I get the privilege of talking to people from every economic background there is. And it's like, they are here for the poor today, but they'll be coming for you next. What are you? What else is there that you are? Who else is in your family that you care about? Like, is your daughter gay? Is your son handicapped in any way? Like, what else is there that you love and you care about? Because the things that we love and we really care about are our families and our friends. And if you can appeal to that place in them, because if you can just imagine living life without the wife that you love so much, that in one moment things can just be ripped away and taken away, then what? That's how people are living every single day. It's not you today, but who knows? It could be you tomorrow.
It could be.
So I'm going to let Liz have the last word on this one. But one of the things I want to add to what you're saying, Ryan, is that fewer of us are benefiting. So what we have is a turnaround. I mean, what we've seen in the past is that there's this range of folks who benefit. But today, few of us are benefiting. You know, more of us have health care that we can't afford, even if we have a, quote, good job. More of us have family members who cannot make it without us giving them a hand. So it's not 1968. So few of us are seeing this great benefit. And so that's one piece of it, that we are feeling it and we can be drawn into it more. So that's one piece of it. The other thing is that when we talk about these struggles in a moral way, from a moral place, people are able to see beyond their own backyards, their own house, and it gives us the ability to think in a different way. So I think that fewer of us are benefiting, and that we have a new way, a moral way to think about things and a different way to organize around these things. So I think that contributes, and it also goes with what Ryan has said.
So, yeah. That is so true, right? I mean, 80% of the country at some point in our lives will not be able to make ends meet, right? I mean, 80%. That's not some small group over there that we're supposed to feel sorry for and think is so different. That three people in this country have as much wealth as 50% of the population. Three people. Hundreds of millions of people. Like, that's insane. That is immoral. It is unjust. And it's unnecessary, right? I mean, I think that it is really important for us to be grounded in the kind of connection that we have to each other. If any person in this world is homeless, we all have the potential of becoming homeless. If any person in this world is discriminated against, we all have the potential of being discriminated against. If any person's vote is taken away from them, we all have the potential of our vote being taken away from us. And so it's not some like nice, let's all link arms and sing kumbaya. Even if we want to do that, we can do that as well. But it's not just this, it's not just rhetoric, but we are in this together. That, you know, in the words of Dr. King, if we don't come together, we'll all perish as fools, right?
Right.
I mean, and I think that we're seeing this across the country. I mean, to see in 38 states and in here in the District of Columbia that there are these unbelievable gatherings of poor people and queer people and Christians and Muslims that are coming together across all the lines that have divided us historically and still currently, and saying, it doesn't have to be this way. So I started seminary. My first day of systematic theology class in Dr. James Cone's class, and rest in power, James Cone, was on 9/11. And I sat in New York City as the towers fell. And many people in my class said, my faith is rocked. How can this be so? And I went back to the community that I was living in and realized that the faith that people who are in struggle have isn't a faith that good things are going to keep on happening to them. Isn't a faith that it's not going to happen to me. It's a faith that even though life has been really bad, really hard, really violent, really poor, that something different is possible. And that something different isn't just for one person or one community, but that that brings about a resurrection for everyone. And I think that that is so true, and we see it in this campaign, right? We see all across this country people living into a reality that isn't yet, but that could be. And we see a power breaking through that I think is infecting people of all walks of life. And not having it be us against them or you know, you're going to take this away from me. We have to rob Peter to pay Paul. No. We have enough money. We have enough resources. We have enough health care. We have enough food that everybody could live a great life, that everybody could have a great education. And so let's stop in this, okay, well, that's going to make my life worse. No. If anyone's life is not great, then my life isn't as good as it could be. And I think people see that.
I thank you for that, bringing that kind of vision and, as it would be said, that prophetic imagination that there can be and there will be something better than where we are right now, no matter the situation. As we have just a few minutes left, we did want to give an opportunity, if there are those, for just a couple of questions, because of those who would like to ask a question, because we do have to make the most of the time, but we have a question. Our director of programs, Michelle Dibley, she's coming to you right now.
Thank you so much. I wanted to thank Bishop Barber, who's now left, for his leadership, and especially the fact that you're including in the campaign the problem of our military-based economy. One of the reasons that so many people west of the river are so wealthy, and Metro DC has the highest concentration of millionaires in the country, I'm told, is because in some way of their connection to the defense industry. Even if it's a journalist who keeps her job by promoting our militant, aggressive foreign policy. But I do have a question that I wanted to ask, and that's about the Poor People's March that's coming here from Philadelphia this week. I think they left today, and they're coming on the 6th. I notice it's not included. And what is the relation between the Poor People's Campaign and the Poor People's March?
Yeah. So things are not good in this country. And we need many, many flowers to bloom. We need everyone to take action in their communities. We need marches, we need rallies, we need civil disobedience, we need prayer vigils. And so a group of poor and homeless families from Philadelphia did set out today, and they are on their way to Washington, D.C. now. And they will bring their voices and add them to many, many others who are organizing and building power and trying to change this country and trying to end poverty and end systemic racism and end ecological devastation and end this war economy and turn it into a peace one. And so there's many things going on. There were marches last week around religious leaders. There's amazing work that is happening. And just like Bishop Barber was talking about, many of these stories we don't hear in our news today. And so it is important for us to take it upon ourselves to get involved, because there's powerful work going on out there. And so it's to be lifted up and celebrated and joined in. And so that's really important.
Certainly, another question.
Greetings. My name is Pastor Kenneth Clark from Brother Life Comes You Our Ministry. I have a question for you as a minister and as a pastor. One of the things that I've known that there's an issue with, how can we create and change the culture for churches to get more involved with as it relates to the Poor People's Campaign? Because I do the work, I go to the churches, let people know what's going on. So how do we change that climate and that culture for that?
Well, in responding to that first, because I have gotten and received that question quite often about how do we change that culture? And I think there are several pieces to this. The first piece is, while we talk about being a faith community, there are sacred texts that are lifted up within all of our faith communities. And what we have to really do is be true to the sacred texts, not just the pieces that make us happy, but the pieces that transform us and help us to be who we've been created to be. And so when we first look at those texts, are we, as I might call sometimes, doing the buffet selection of what we want and passing over the things that we need? Whenever I go out to eat, and I think my wife is here somewhere, she knows I'll pass the vegetables because I want everything else, and those things. But, you know, still, in growing up, the things that I really need to eat, the leader has to take the responsibility to make sure that everyone's eating well. I say that first, that if we're going to change that culture, let's be true that, as the scripture was lifted today, that I'm mindful of the sick and the hurt and the needy and those who are suffering, the widows and the orphans, that we're mindful of that. It has been lifted, and I will reiterate again and join in, that we have to be in and among the people. I have not come to be served, but I've come to serve. And the leader has a responsibility to put themselves in service positions. And that has to be seen and not just said, so that persons would be able to see that. Will more of us who have held or hold these leadership positions of pastoring, and that we're out there on the front lines while we're saying to everyone else they should be out on the front lines? Are we saying, when we really mean it, follow me, that we're asking people to walk with me and not just sending people to do what you will never do yourself? That's another piece that's in there. And then we've got to build the relationships of trust. That third level, very shortly in there, that it's hard to have bullets flying over your head, to be in the midst of chaos, and not know the person who's really next to you. And so when we build these relationships, as it says, we can get a whole lot more together than we could ever do individually. There's the old witness that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go with somebody else. And so what I pray, and I hope that I'm answering your question from that perspective, is that what we want to do is not just go fast, but we want to go far. And that's what this campaign is really all about, going far.
Amen.
Is there another question? What time for one more question? I can hear the echo.
So this question is, what questions do we ask candidates for office? Elections are coming soon.
Anyone want to, locally, nationally?
If you are a DC resident and you vote in this city, Phil Mendelson is, his chair's up, his city chair. Ask him about violence in this city. Ask him if he's going to hold the mayor accountable, because he's the one who can do that. He's the person who can do this, who can hold the mayor accountable. He's the one that the rest of the council comes to, budget issues. They want to be his BFF during budget season and through everything else. So one vote, because historically we don't vote. It doesn't matter what ward you're in. DC has the lowest voter turnout across all 8 wards, not just in 7 and 8, but all 8 wards. Vote, take 20, 30, 40 people with you, but vote. But yeah, go talk to Phil and see what he has to say, and hold him accountable. Because I think that just asking questions during campaigns is good, voting is better, but holding them accountable once they are in office is even better.
Let me say, certainly, as we're going to be moving our time, I want to say thank you to Ryan Nickens for being here, Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris, and certainly Attorney Pellis. I called you Reverend at the beginning. There we go. But I'm grateful for the three of you coming and spending time, and Dr. Barber being here today. I want to remind everybody that we will be, of course, engaging in action tomorrow and over the next several Mondays. And don't forget June 23rd. I'm thankful for our dean, who, of course, is encouraging movements in space like this, and our programs director, Michelle Dibley, who helps to lead this and move all this together. But let me say thank you to each and every one of you for being here today. And we come into places like this so that we can leave differently than the way we came in. So I thank you today, and I hope that you'll leave here different than the way you walked in the door. But you've come in here to worship, but perhaps now we're ready to go out to serve. So have a wonderful day today.